from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Dave Iverson. Puberty is arriving for girls earlier than ever. A new study out this week shows that more girls today are likely to start developing breasts by age 7 or 8. What researchers don't know is why. It may be related to obesity. There could be a connection to chemicals in our environment. Race appears to be a factor. There could even be a role that stress plays in triggering the phenomenon. We'll explore the research and what the findings mean for the health of children. That's next on Forum, after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Dave Iverson, sitting in today for Michael Krasny. Why are more girls showing signs of early puberty? A new study of over 1,000 girls, including girls here in the Bay Area, shows that girls as young as 7 and 8 are more likely than in the past to show signs of breast development. Nearly 20% of white girls had started breast development by age 8. For Hispanic girls, that figure increases to 31%. And breast development at age 8 is now seen in over 40% of black girls. The trend in early puberty has been documented pretty consistently over the past 10 years, but why that trend is taking place remains something of a mystery. Obesity appears to play a role. What's less clear is the role of environmental chemicals and societal factors. In this hour of Forum, we're going to take a look at what the new study tells us and what health concerns that prompts for our children. Joining us to do that, Dr. Louise Greenspan. She's a pediatric endocrinologist at Kaiser Permanente San Francisco and at the Division of Research, and she's one of the co-authors of this study. Dr. Greenspan, good morning.
Thank you. Good morning.
Joining us, too, is Dr. Juliana Deerdorf. She's assistant professor of maternal and child health programs at the School of Public Health at the University of California, Berkeley, and she was also involved as an investigator in this research. Dr. Deerdorf, good morning.
Good morning.
Well, thanks both very much for coming in to talk about this study that I think is eye-opening for lots of us. Dr. Greenspan, walk us through some of the basic findings. What we've seen, as I mentioned in the introduction, this trend, it's been available in research for a while, but did it open your eyes too? Were you surprised that this sign of breast development occurred more increasingly at such an early age?
I was partially surprised. As a clinical pediatric endocrinologist, I see a lot of girls on a daily basis who are being referred to me for early puberty. So I knew from my clinical experience that this was becoming more of a common problem. But over the 5 years that we've been doing the study, I was surprised at how large the percentage was of girls with breast development in their seventh year.
And what is significant about the fact that the sign seems to be breast development as opposed to early menstruation or other things that we typically associate with puberty?
Well, we are in the fifth year of this study, and this is a longitudinal study, which we started when the girls were 6 to 8 years of age. So we haven't gotten to the point where we can assess the age of first menstruation. So we were first looking at breast development and pubic hair. And in another couple years, we will have more data about menstruation.
So that may be going on too. It's just that that research is not complete?
Yes. We don't know if that's going on. We do know now that breast and pubic hair development are earlier than in the past. And we don't know if the average age of menarche or first menstruation has dropped. And there are other research that suggests it has. And in our study, we'll be looking at that.
And what about some of the whys? There does seem to be this connection, Dr. Deerdorf, to obesity in particular. Tell us what we know about that and why that would be so.
Sure. Well, I probably should defer that to Dr. Greenspan because she also runs an obesity clinic at Kaiser Permanente and sees girls for kind of a multitude of issues involving obesity and early puberty. But we do know that obesity is accounting for, in large part, for the secular trend, but isn't accounting for all the variants.
And is there something particular that obesity does that triggers that hormonal response?
Well, fat cells are related to estrogen production. So it may be that simply having more fat cells increases your estrogen levels, which then is triggering an earlier pubertal tempo or faster puberty. But it may also be what's causing the fat itself. So are girls heavier because there's something different about their nutrition, which in turn is correlated with early puberty?
So we don't know, this is a bad analogy, sorry, but which is chicken and which is egg?
In a way, no, we don't. And we are looking at those things through time in our study. So we're getting dietary assessments. We're looking at activity levels. We're trying to see, is it obesity per se, or is it related to the nutrition and the exercise that cause obesity?
So, but it could be that one of the reasons, because we talk about and read about this all the time, about the problem of childhood obesity in this country, it could be that what's going on hormonally and chemically is triggering the obesity problem rather than the other way around?
Yes, we don't know.
And is it obesity as it's officially defined that is connected to this problem, or is it just being overweight to any degree?
Well, we were looking purely at body mass index initially, although we also have measured body fat percentage in our study. But in this particular publication, we were looking at purely height for weight at a certain age. And we have percentiles for what is healthy and what is considered unhealthy for that.
Dr. Louise Greenspan, she's a pediatric endocrinologist at Kaiser Permanente San Francisco and also with their division of research, one of the co-authors in this study. One of the things that's also striking about this, Dr. Deardorff, is this racial divide. I know you've worked particularly with a lot of Hispanic girls. And again, let me just read these numbers because they're striking, and you want to know why this might be. At age 7, white girls, 10% have breast development. Hispanic girls, 15. Blacks, 23. At 8, that bumps up to whites, 18%. Latinos, 31%. Black girls, 43%. Do we know what's going on there?
You know, we're not quite sure. I think this is where the research is right now, is trying to tease apart what piece of this might be heritable, genetic, based on race and ethnicity, and what piece of this might be overexposure to some of the risk factors that we suspect might lead to early puberty.
So it could be, in other words, that there's nothing biological or genetic going on here. It's just that African-American girls might have more problems with being exposed to chemicals that are problematic, or might have a greater problem with obesity, and that's the causal agent, not something that's genetic?
Well, it's possible. We know in our country that certain underrepresented groups get stuck in circumstances that are less than optimal. And there's also some evidence that different environmental stressors, in addition to the toxins in the food that we eat, might also be predicting earlier puberty among girls.
Environmental stressors meaning?
So there's a good deal of research that suggests that issues within the family conflict, neighborhood disorganization and stress in the neighborhood may cause girls to go through puberty earlier, to become more reproductively ready, if you will, at earlier ages.
So something as basic as stress itself, if you live in a highly stressful environment where things aren't going well, that stress can trigger hormonal output?
There's some evidence that suggests that. And it seems that for these young girls in particular, ages 0 to 7 might be particularly important in terms of programming some of those reproductive readiness types of things, so early puberty being one of them.
Dr. Juliana Deardorff, she's with the Maternal and Child Health Program at the School of Public Health at the University of California, Berkeley, also involved in the research that came out in this new study. I want to come back to all of these factors and plumb them further. But before we do that, let's talk some about what we should be concerned about here in terms of its significance for health. I imagine any parent, and I know you're both mothers of fairly young girls, do this research and you have to have a kind of, oh my God, what do I do? So, or what does this mean? What does this portend? Dr. Greenspan, what does it portend in terms of the health of children?
Well, we know that the earlier you have your period, the higher your risk of breast cancer and other estrogen-mediated cancers.
So earlier period, not necessarily earlier breast development?
Well, that's what we're looking at right now. This was originally a breast cancer-related study, yes. But also we know that it has tremendous psychological burden in terms of being at risk for sexual abuse and also consensual sexual activity probably before it's really age appropriate.
On the cancer part first, I mean, Risk is one of those things that I think it's oftentimes we in the media don't do a very good job of being very precise about. You know, we'll say it increases your risk by 30%, but that might mean from 1% to 1.3%, and it's really not necessarily that huge. So put that in some context for us.
Yes, there are – for breast cancer, there are modifiable and unmodifiable risks, and the age of your first period is really the one unmodifiable risk. The other known risks are how old you are when you have your first baby, whether you breastfeed or not, your obesity, smoking, other things. So the age at first menarche is really the one thing that women cannot control that can really increase their risk. Besides, I should also say genetic risks, obviously you can't control. But beyond that, for the other causes, earlier menarche under age 11 is associated. I can't give you an exact number. I think that we're learning so much more about breast cancer.
So, and again, by earlier menarche, commonly we think of that as earlier menstruation,
yes,
correct?
Excuse me, okay. Yes. Menarche is the first period.
And so can you put that in any kind of comparative risk element? I mean, where does that stand? Dr. Dierdorf.
Well, we do know that for every year that you can delay menarche, that you reduce the risk for breast cancer. The numbers vary depending on the study that you look at, but probably about – some folks have said 4 to 7%. Some said that think that your risk increases 10 to 20% in terms of going through menarche early versus later.
I mean, it sounds significant. And that's cumulative? So if it's delayed from 8 to 12, that becomes 25 to 30% improvement?
That's what the breast cancer researchers seem to think, right. So I think that the key is just to, if you can move that bar just a little bit, and then if you look at the other modifiable risk factors that Louise was mentioning, that you could actually ameliorate some of your risk.
So how do you move that bar?
That's a great question. I think, and in our study, I think, and just to note, I'm also on this. I wasn't a co-author on this study, but I'm part of the study that Louise is involved in. What we're trying to do is look at many factors. So we're looking at factors such as toxins, environmental toxins. We're looking at aspects of the psychosocial realm, which we've already referred to, some of the family stressors. We're taking a look at nutrition and diet and physical activity. And I think many of those are modifiable.
Well, let's walk through them then one by one. I mean, starting with obesity, since we're again, a problem that gets so much attention right now in America. And since you work with obese children, Dr. Greenspan, what makes the most difference there? Do we know what can do that? Is it nutrition? Is it exercise? What do we know about how we modify that risk factor?
We need to make improvements in all of the above, especially for families that don't have access to good, healthy food in their environments. So specifically, the things we like to focus on are getting daily exercise. And a lot of kids sit at home and are using screens, whether they're TV or computer or video games. And we need to get them outside and active every day. We also need to make sure we do simple things that are simple to say but not simple to do, including limiting sugary drink intake. And really, kids should just be drinking water or milk and not drinking juice and certainly not drinking soda.
And is this an example of what you were both referencing earlier, that again, it's difficult to tease out here which is what's genetic and what's environmental? It could be, again, the things that you're talking about have to be particular problems, one would think, associated with certain minority communities and poverty. So changing those factors may, in fact, also change those racial statistics that we were describing before.
Yes, that's correct. And more than that, we are also looking at built environment in our study, which means where people live and what's around them. And across the street, do they have a Whole Foods or do they have a bodega? Yeah. That has no fresh fruits and vegetables.
How are you – you work in the Mission, I know, too. And how is that playing out? Is there a greater sense of awareness? Are there interesting pilot programs that are happening, whether that's in the Mission or around the Bay Area, that are seemingly making a dent in this particular part of the problem?
You know, I think that there is a focus on obesity and physical activity, but folks aren't really linking it to early pubertal timing or some of the downstream effects of going through puberty early, especially if you're a girl. I mean, we really see these profound effects for girls when they go through puberty early. The dent's not really being made around the early puberty issue. I think the focus is on obesity. And, of course, we have kind of a national agenda right now to try to reform some of the issues in the school with school lunches and whatnot. But locally, it hasn't happened. There's not a lot of movement.
And on the environmental front, what is it that's out there that you think is a possible candidate that may chemically be influencing this? Is that – bisphenol A, which we get a lot of attention to that appears in plastics? Is it flame retardants? What sort of chemicals are we talking about, Dr. Greenspan?
Yeah, we are looking – and some of this data is not yet analyzed. So we are – but we are looking at exposure to plastics, including bisphenol A and phthalates. We're looking at exposure to cigarettes. We're looking at exposure to flame retardants, certain insecticides, and other chemicals. And we are looking at these girls' exposures through questionnaires as well as urine and blood.
So – again, this is research I know that will take time to be definitive. It's the nature of science that it's not something that you can make instant recommendations, I know. But in the meantime, parents out there are wanting to think about how you move that bar, as you put it earlier, Dr. Deardorff. So what do you do in the meantime? What do you counsel people?
So there's something called the precautionary principle, which is a little bit different from the way that we've been thinking about chemicals in our country. In the past, you have to prove that a chemical is harmful before it can be banned. And there's a different way of approaching that, which is thinking that you need to wait till you find out that a chemical is safe. So for example, if you don't know if a chemical is harmful or not, then you don't use it. So that being said, personally, I try and minimize my children's exposure to bisphenol A. I try and feed them organic food. It is more expensive, and it may not be better for them, but I know it's better for the environment and better for the workers who take care of it.
And again, for people who aren't familiar, bisphenol A appears commonly in what sorts of products?
In plastics, in linings for food, in linings of bottles.
So again,
food storage.
If you're bottle feeding a baby, then mm-hmm. that's compounding perhaps that issue.
There now, in the last couple of years since I had my first child, there's been a phenomenal increase in the number of bisphenol A free products. So it is possible, but they're more expensive. The cheap bottles, the cheap sippy cups, the cheap food storage containers all have bisphenol A in them.
So again, Dr. Deardorff, we're right back to economics and, mm-hmm. and the role that class plays in this. These are choices that you may be able to make, but people listening to this program in West Oakland or somewhere else may not.
Precisely.
But I do think what's important to note is that even though there are racial ethnic differences in when girls are going through puberty, the secular trend that we're noting is happening in all racial ethnic groups. Mm-hmm. And what was so profound about the study that just came out of our group is that it appears to be even earlier than the previous studies for non-Hispanic white girls. So I think I want to emphasize that we should be paying attention to this regardless of what our affluence level is.
The gap has narrowed since the last study that looked at white versus African-American girls 13 years ago.
So everyone's moving up in this scale.
Yes.
What about the other consequence of this in terms of health more broadly defined, mental health, the concern that children are sexualized earlier, that men, boys may look at those girls in a different way. What about some of those concerns, Dr. Deardorff?
I think that those are the concerns that parents come to me with most, and both in the context of the clinical work that I do and also in the context of our study. We've now been with these families for 5 years, and their girls are now coming into full-on puberty. They're not just starting puberty. The girls are around 11 years old at this point, and they're very concerned. You know, parents are very concerned about the sexual material that kids are exposed to on TV and in the media, and they ask me, what do I do? And, you know, my advice is these girls are not doomed, you know, if they go through puberty earlier. We have to keep in mind that people go through puberty. All of us have gone through puberty and we've survived it. That many girls who go through puberty early do quite well, but we should kind of minimize the other risk factors in their life. So all the things that you would do as a good parent, you should just make sure you're doing. You know, keep in good communication with your kids. Know who they're with. Monitor what they're doing. And make sure that they understand what's happening to their bodies, especially if it's happening earlier than their peers.
So it means, in a sense, you have to find a way to have age-appropriate the conversation that every parent winds up having with a child that you might have thought in the past you'd had at age 10 or 11 or 12 or whatever. You're now going to have to figure out a way to have that conversation with a second grader.
That's exactly right. You have to start having those conversations early if the body is developing earlier. And there's a great book by American Girl that talks about your body, and it's The Care and Keeping of You. And it really goes through kind of just basic hygiene all the way up to my breasts are developing. And so there are ways to sit down and talk with your daughter in a way that's age appropriate if this is happening early.
Mention the title again, because I suspect that's something that, parents might want to find out
about. It's an American Girl book. It's called The Care and Keeping of You. And I think it's called The Body Book. Is that right?
And I think it's important to realize that you can separate this from sexuality.
Mm-hmm.
And you can have an age appropriate discussion.
Absolutely.
I do this in my office with 5-year-olds. I've done this with my children about what happens during puberty, the way your body changes, just like your teeth fall out.
Mm-hmm.
And daddy grows a mustache and mommy gets breast, you know, mommy has breasts or whatever you want to say, what happens? Puberty is the process where little girls turn into women and little boys turn into men. And it doesn't have to be getting into other things that you're not ready to discuss with your 7-year-old.
Again, here's the title of the book. It's called The Care and Keeping of You, The Body Book for Girls from American Girl Library, The Care and Keeping of You.
And what's nice about that book is it puts the context of puberty into the context of make sure you wash your hair and make sure you, mm-hmm. you know, what you need to cut your nails and what lice is. And it just puts it into the bigger context of your body.
What about behavior that we also associate with puberty, Dr. Deardorff? I mean, you know, we all hear the sort of raging hormones question. Maybe we think about that more about boys. And we should come back to boys at some point in this conversation, hear about what's going on with them. But does this also mean that 7- and 8-year-old girls are starting to act in ways that we typically associate more with middle schoolers or early teenagers?
Right. I think that's kind of the phenomenon of tweening that people are talking about so much nowadays. I would say yes and no. I mean, the idea of raging hormones and our children are just going to get out of control and we have to keep them in a box until they reach adulthood in order to keep them safe, that's pretty much been debunked over the past couple decades. What we do know, though, is that there is a lot of neurological development during this time, quick neurological development, that they may start approaching risk behaviors earlier than they would otherwise and not have kind of the cognitive scaffolding to deal with how fast their impulses are.
There was a fascinating Frontline documentary on public television a number of years ago called, I think, Inside the Teenage Brain. And it talked about how teens just are literally wired different neurologically.
Mm-hmm.
So could that extend, in other words, to 7- or 8-year-olds, that wiring process that causes young people to really take in the world in a different way might be taking place sooner?
Well, I think that's exactly what we're trying to figure out right now. And that is that's the supposition, is that there is a biological piece of you that is kind of thrusting you forward and that development happens on multiple levels and they're not always synchronous. So, for instance, you're going to be changing neurologically, but you're also going to have cognitive and social changes, and that you might not – they're not happening at the same time. And so you might not be developing the skills socially as early and the cognitive skills as early as you are developing in other ways.
Dr. Greenspan.
Yeah, what I see in my clinical practice is a lot of girls who are having issues controlling their anger with their family, not necessarily with their peers. But we always joke that slam doors is a sign of puberty. So girls who basically are having these emotional outbursts that are related to hormones, but they really don't have the frontal lobe or the cognitive ability to really control themselves. So the feelings are valid, but they are not able to control those feelings in a way that a 12-year-old might be better able to control them.
Is it your sense also then that all of this in the end circles back, of course, to the job of being a parent, and that this is just one more thing that's become that much more complicated, that much more challenging, that much more that you have to be tuned into at an earlier age?
Yes, although I have to say it also complicates pediatricians' roles, and there are health concerns because there are still girls who have brain tumors or abnormalities in their brains that are causing early puberty. And our job as a pediatrician, or my job as a pediatric endocrinologist, is to figure out which girls have the real problems and which girls are early normal developers. And we used to use the cutoff of 8. And now our job as healthcare providers is more complicated because which 7-year-olds do we need to work out?
Yeah.
And
yeah.
we don't want to subject them to unnecessary blood tests and MRIs, but we also don't want to miss the brain tumor.
So there's a worry about assuming this is the new normal and losing something that could be much more serious.
Correct.
Yeah. Dr. Louise Greenspan, a pediatric endocrinologist, Kaiser Permanente, San Francisco, one of the co-authors of the new study, joining us along with Dr. Juliana Deardorff, also involved in this research, an assistant professor of maternal and child health programs at UC Berkeley. We're going to open up our phone lines and take your questions as well. Is this a problem that you're contending with in your own family? What are the questions that you have for either Dr. Deardorff or Dr. Greenspan? Here's the number if you want to join us. It's 866-733-6786, 866-733-6786. Email us at forum@kqed.org or go to our website, kqed.org/forum, and add your comments there and we'll get them on the air. This is Forum. I'm Dave Iverson. Welcome back to Forum. I'm Dave Iverson, sitting in this hour for Michael Krasny. Our topic, early puberty in girls and what's going on that may be triggering that phenomenon. Is it something in the environment? Does it have to do with obesity? Are there social stresses that are affecting that as well? We'd like your questions included in our conversation. Here's how to participate. The number is 866-733-6786, 866-733-6786. Email us at forum@kqed.org or go to our website, kqed.org/forum, and add your comments there. Lots of emails already coming in. Let's go through a couple of these quickly and see what we can answer. Paul writes in, was the study controlled for sleep? There's considerable juvenile sleep deprivation that seems to be epidemic. Might that be playing a role in stressing the overall hormone system?
That's one hypothesis that we are investigating, and we are asking about sleep in our study, and we'll have data on that.
Pam writes in, a few weeks ago, we had a family from France visiting us. We were all amazed at how young the children looked. A 14-year-old boy looked more like an American 12-year-old, showing no signs of puberty. An 11-year-old girl showed no signs of puberty at all. So what do we know about differences between the developed world and the third world, European countries versus other nations? Do we have a sense of how that varies around the world, Dr. Greenspan?
Well, the first comment I would have or question is, were the children looking younger because of the way they were dressed? Hmm. Because did these people actually see the kids naked, or was it that they were appearing and that they were dressing in a more, quote, age-appropriate manner? There is evidence coming out of Northern Europe that this is happening there as well.
And Betsy writes in, could this be related to the growth hormone that we sometimes ingest from meat? Theoretically, wouldn't lower-income girls have less access to high-quality, hormone-free meat products? Dr. Dierdorf?
I think that's a great question. And one of the things that the California site kind of took the lead in was to make sure that we had questions about whether you were eating organic, both in terms of your meat consumption and also your milk and other products, organic products. And we'll have some more information about that in not too long.
Lee wants to know about the relationship to exercise. In other species, females reach puberty when they're ready to bear children. There's reason to believe that that was true of our own species 100,000 years ago or so, when we lived the strenuous life of hunters and gatherers. Now our relatively sedentary, high-caloric lifestyle, has that confused the metabolic mechanisms nature used to determine the right point for puberty?
That's another hypothesis we're testing. We had these girls tell us what they were doing, but also wear for 3 days at a time each year a device that lets us know how much they're exercising. There is a theory that it's the amount of fat that you have, and that more muscly girls might go through puberty later because they have less adipose cells or less fat tissue.
Sometimes the way in which for athletes or dancers, for example, that affects the menstrual cycle as well?
Yeah, that's the opposite. That's not having enough adipose tissue, and that's too much stress.
Right, but too much exercise could have a so when we're talking about, going back to your phrase before, Dr. Dierdorf, about moving the bar, we talked about nutrition and being careful about a variety of chemical factors, but another thing would just be getting kids out and exercising.
Right, and I think that's really a great place to start thinking about modifiable factors and the built environment and what kinds of things we have in our environment to get us out and get us moving. And more movement in the schools. The problem is, if you eat a Big Mac, it's going to take you about 8 hours of basketball to work it off.
Wow.
So we got to think about energy in and energy out.
You know, it's now increasingly common to see at restaurants what the calories are of something you eat, but it might be even more effective, Dr. Dierdorf, if you saw on that sign, Big Mac equals 8 hours of playing basketball.
Absolutely.
Gladys writes in, I'm 34 years old and of mixed race. I started developing very early, around 8 or 9 years old. Even though I was 2 months premature as an infant, I grew fast, was done growing by seventh grade. I was definitely the first in my peer group to go through puberty, but luckily my pediatrician recognized the signs and worked with my mother to educate me. It's a good point about the importance that pediatricians really play in this role. Is this something that all pediatricians are increasingly tuned into, do you think?
I hope so. I think that, as I said, the old teaching used to be age 8 was normal. And I think more pediatricians are realizing they're seeing it earlier. But again, I do worry. In that situation, someone who's born premature is at risk for earlier puberty.
Why is that?
Probably,
I would think it would be the other way around, that there would be a lot of catch-up to do.
There are a lot of late effects of prematurity, and one of them can be early puberty. It's probably a late stress response.
By the way, we should just get in a quick nod to boys in all of this. There's actually been some work that shows that obesity has the opposite effect on boys. Is that right, Dr.
Yeah,
Greenspan? That obesity delays puberty in boys?
That is correct, although we are also seeing clinically a phenomenon of boys with early pubic hair that's not true puberty.
And And so why would that – why would they have different effects? Why would obesity affect boys one way and girls another?
We don't know. We don't really know the triggers of puberty. We fundamentally don't know what's going on in the brain that triggers puberty. So there is ongoing research by other investigators in that.
And to our calls, Michael joins us first in Oakland. Michael, go ahead, please.
Yes, please. My 7.5-year-old daughter is experiencing precocious puberty, and she's in the Kaiser system, and we're set up for an appointment with an endocrinologist later this month. Is there medications that the endocrinologist might recommend that we should be aware of or concerned about or just okay with? Because our pediatrician said that if you don't treat precocious puberty, there's a chance that this increased puberty or early onset might cause problems later on with growth. Or is that we also did a bone check, and her bone growth is normal.
Michael, thanks. Dr. Greenspan.
So obviously, without knowing more clinical details, I'm glad to hear you had a bone age. That's the X-ray of the hand, which can look at the estrogen effects on the bone. And that helps us differentiate true precocious puberty from the phenomenon that we're describing in this paper. So there's a phenomenon that's been around a lot longer than this, which is where girls do have true puberty too early. And those girls get their periods at age 7 or 8. And that's a medical issue that needs addressing. That's differentiated from what we're describing in this paper. And the girls in this paper, we didn't look at bone ages. But presumably, if your bone age is normal, it's not as big a problem. The issue with growth is that girls stop growing within about 2 years of the first period. So if you get your first period at 9, you're done growing at 11. Wow. If you get your first period at 14, you're done growing at 16. And you obviously are a lot shorter if you end up growing less.
And Michael's other question about medication that he should have his eyes open about.
So the medication that you would discuss with your pediatric endocrinologist is called Lupron, and it's a medication that basically shuts down the brain's messages to the ovaries and stops puberty from progressing. And in cases of true early puberty, where we think that the first period is going to occur before age 9 or 10, we can use this. It may not affect height in a 7.5-year-old, but it would certainly, if used in an appropriate manner, allow her to be more mature when she gets her first period.
And are there side effects, other concerns that parents ought to be thinking about who are in this circumstance?
Well, obviously, they should always discuss those side effects personally with their physician. The Lupron can cause osteoporosis if it's used for too long a time because it prevents estrogen from increasing the bone mineral density, and it stops the calcium from getting into your bones. So we don't like to use it forever. Some people would like to postpone that girl's puberty forever, and we really can't do that. So it's a risk-benefit balance that has to be decided on an individual basis.
Michael, thanks for the call. Let's go next to Bill, who joins us on the Sirius Satellite Network, or rather to Mary in San Francisco. Mary, go ahead, please.
Hi, good morning. I just want to say to the lady, I brought my daughter the book, Knowing Your Body, about the puberty and the nails and the hair and all of that. It's an excellent book. However, I had 2 questions. One is, I hear a lot of people say that the average age for a period is 11 years old, and she just turned 11 in May. And the second question is, her knee swells a lot, and I think they call it the Schrader-Osgood. Is that part of the puberty that goes on, you know, being small or whatever with children? So
okay,
please answer those 2 questions.
Yeah, thank you, Mary. Let's see if we can help at least as much as we can. Dr. Deardorff?
Sure, I can answer the first question. So on average, puberty is occurring closer to 12.5 nationally.
Now, when we say – sorry to interject.
Sure.
But when we say puberty –
I'm sorry, menarche.
Okay,
menarche.
So, all right.
Yeah,
so,
thanks for the correction.
First menstruation
right,
happens
exactly.
Closer to again?
Closer to 12.5 on
okay.
average. A little younger as we're speaking about race ethnicity differences, a little younger for African American girls. So if we're talking about menarche, that's more the average age. Now, I don't know about the second question, and I don't know that Dr. Greenspan does either.
I think you may have been referring to Osgood Slaughter, which does occur with times of rapid growth. And for that, I think you need to really address that with your pediatrician.
Okay, Mary?
You do have a good day. I love your show, by the way.
All right. Thanks, Mary. Thanks for the call. And now to Bill in Chicago. Bill, go ahead, please.
Yes, my question. Earlier, your guests were mentioning chemical triggers, and I was wondering if any studies have been done on the effects of bovine growth hormone with increased milk consumption, if that's part of what's accounting for the growth in breasts.
Thanks, Bill, for the call. We did touch on that briefly, but Dr. Deardorff, you want to go through that once more?
You know, I'm probably not the best person to answer it, but we do have someone who specializes in toxins on our study. Do you have any?
No, we're looking at that through dietary histories. Although growth hormone is a different axis than puberty, so it's a little the plausibility is a little lower because of the endocrinologic issues.
Here's an important question that I should have gotten to sooner. You've mentioned white, black, and Latino communities, but what about Asian and East Indian populations? Don't we count?
Well, yes, absolutely. And one of the strengths of a San Francisco site, this study was done in Cincinnati and New York as well, was that we did have about 50 girls in our site out of 400 that were Asian. Unfortunately, it wasn't enough to be able to make a statistical correlation at this point, but nobody else has published anything about Asian girls in America. So we will be able to accrue some data on that.
Sorry, go ahead, Dr. Jerker.
What we do know is that Asian girls tend to go through puberty later. Now, of course, when we say Asian, that's a big mix of different folks from different origins. So, and as Dr. Greenspan said, we have about 50 girls, and they span everything from Chinese Americans to Filipino Americans. And so to make big generalizations is difficult at this time, but puberty tends to start later among those girls, closer to where non-Hispanic whites.
And when do you think you'll have enough data to make some assessments about those other populations?
So we are currently starting year 6, and this is data from year 1 to 2. So it's going to be coming out. Each year we'll be getting more and more information. And we probably won't be able to publish about Age of Menarche for another 4 years until all the girls have gone through puberty.
Again, if you'd like to join our conversation, we welcome your calls and your emails. Lots coming in. We'll get to as many as we can. 866-733-6786 is the number, 866-733-6786. Email us at forum@kqed.org or go online, kqed.org/forum. And to Michael in Muncie, Indiana. Michael, go ahead.
Yes, hi. I'm a medical oncologist, and I've been working for 3 years in this field. And myself and other senior partners, we've noticed that there's an incidence of breast cancer as women become younger and younger. And I think we're talking about an estrogen issue here. And what I would like to also mention to Drs. Greenspan and Deardorff that in their research, if they're looking at genetically modified organisms, particularly soy crops, we know this is one of the principal crops that involves this type of manipulation. And soy is an estrogenic type compound. So I'd like to ask their opinion.
Michael, thanks. Thanks very much for joining us with those questions. Let's go through them both.
That's a great question. We are actually looking at soy intake, and we're looking at the types of soy. Soy is a very interesting compound because it looks like early exposure to soy may be protective. And that may be part of the issue with the breast cancer rates changing in women who come from countries where there's high soy intake when they come here. So the theory is that if you are exposed to soy before puberty, your body might downregulate its estrogen receptors, and then you actually end up going through puberty slightly later. Whereas if you aren't exposed to soy early in life and you're exposed to soy postpubertally, your body sort of doesn't know what to do with the estrogen-related compounds, and then treats that like estrogen. So we are looking at that in our study.
I thought our doctor was also suggesting that there may be something going on with genetically modified crops and soy in particular. Do we know about that?
No, we don't. Not yet.
But that could be something that's going on?
Yeah, and that's not something that we're looking at in this study.
We're just looking at soy intake.
The other part of his question was that breast cancer is now showing up earlier in young women. Either of you are aware of any indications along those lines?
Right. I mean, there have been trends, especially in certain racial ethnic groups, towards early onset breast cancer. But we really don't know much about the links between puberty and that phenomenon.
Brandon in San Jose has our next question. Brandon, go ahead, please.
I guess I was really just thinking, and you touched on a lot of this, that a lot of what is found here should have kind of been we expected that. We've known for a long time that if you have a gluten-rich diet, that gluten restricts the amount of estrogen in the system. We know that more activity reduces the amount of estrogen in the system. And we know that an increase in soy increases estrogen-like factors in the system. And because we're seeing the prevalence of soy in diets, the reduction of gluten in diets, and the increase in inactivity, we should have just expected estrogen levels in children were going up, and this study would have just confirmed that.
Brandon, thanks. This is where things can get complicated, and I'm not sure I'm getting every part of that. So let's walk through this, because honestly, I'm not even sure about the estrogen level connection here. So what should we be paying attention to that Brandon is raising, whether that's about gluten-free or other aspects of diet?
Well, this doesn't directly address what Brandon is saying, but I think we have to keep in mind that we're not just talking about breast development, which is very much you know, based on an axis, that, a hormonal axis that involves estrogen. We're also talking about earlier pubic hair, which is part of the adrenal axis. And I'm going to go ahead and defer to Dr. Greenspan in terms of the hormonal components there.
I think what he said, what Brandon said at first was, this is sort of not surprising. The whole way along, I haven't been surprised by this. But I think it's a difference between conjecture and getting evidence.
So help me with understanding, what is there an appropriate level of estrogen? Is estrogen a good thing?
Yes.
I mean, how should we modulate that, I guess?
So what people don't understand about the hypothalamic pituitary axis, which is the axis that controls hormones related to puberty in the body, is that we are all born in a state of mini puberty. And over the first couple months, that's suppressed. And then in late childhood, we used to say 8 to 10 in girls and 9 to 11 in boys, that suppression lifts, and we don't know the exact mechanism that releases that suppression. Other people are doing more basic science-oriented research to look at that. And then puberty is unleashed. But it's a normal state. The body's normal state is to be in puberty. In fact, when you have kids with other brain issues like severe seizure disorders or cerebral palsy, they actually might go into puberty early related to the unveiling of the puberty. Puberty is a normal state of the human body. So we always have – girls and boys have a very, very low levels of estrogen. It just – there are factors that raise that during puberty.
Comment from Vivian from our website. I have an 8-year-old daughter who's developing breasts. She's white, slightly overweight, but has a healthy diet. We're working on increasing her physical activity. Is this something that should be treated medically? No, that's hard to know, but how do you approach that sort of general situation?
I think the first thing is always to address it with the pediatrician. What looks like breast tissue may not be breast tissue, and you want an experienced clinician to feel it or palpate it, because chubby girls sometimes have a little bit of chub in their chest area. And that's what's unique about this study. We did actually palpate over 1,200 girls every year and check what their breast levels were. So I think making sure that this is real breast tissue would be a start. And I think making sure you have a conversation with the pediatrician about how rapidly this is progressing. Because if there's a normal growth rate and no other signs of puberty, then continuing to do what she's doing is appropriate.
So we have to be careful about overreacting as well as reacting.
Well, I guess I also worry about underreacting. Again, I don't want to miss those girls that have the other issues. But yes, we want to be moderate here.
Another milk question. What role do hormones in milk play? Should we be looking at the food pyramid? And are we possibly pushing the wrong food groups at African-American and Hispanic families? I don't know if this gets into the whole question of lactose intolerance that's more prevalent in African-American families. But any thoughts on that, Dr. Turdorf?
Well, I think there are two questions there. And one question goes back to the hormone question, which I think we've addressed, in that we really don't know a lot about how hormone additives are affecting our children's development, but we're hoping that as the study marches along over time, we'll be able to tease some of that apart. The other question is about interactions and interactions between race, ethnicity, and diet, race, ethnicity, and nutrition. And what's unique about this study, particularly because it's across three sites, we've been able to get data on over 1,200 girls, that we will have the statistical power, if you will, to look at some of those interactions. So if you're an African-American girl eating a certain type of diet, does that tend to accelerate your puberty more quickly, and does physical activity play into that to modify that in some way?
So the goal in the end is to really be precise, to really drill down on this and to be able to say, if this is your situation, do X. If this is your situation, do Y.
To the extent possible, sure.
And to Al in Sacramento. Al, go ahead, please.
Hi. I understand that when you are exposed to certain chemicals, they accumulate in your body. Say those plastic chemicals that you were talking about, how long does it take for those to start dissipating out of the blood system and out of the body?
Great question, Al. Not sure we can answer. Any thoughts on how quickly it takes or whether those are in you forever?
It varies with compounds, and it varies with the dose and how old the person is. So children may have a weaker ability to metabolize some of these things.
We've talked some about these chemical environmental factors, but Dr. Jerdorf, talk a little more, if you would, about sort of social environmental factors. I know one of the things you've both thought about and begun to look into is just the family situation itself,
right,
and the role of stress and the role of men in the household, whether or not there's a man in the household, for example, who's not biologically related, and whether that's a stressor that may in some ways wind up triggering early puberty.
Right. So I always feel like I'm touching the third rail when I talk about family issues. But there is persistent and robust evidence in the empirical literature for decades now, showing that if a biological father is absent from the home, that girls are twice as likely about to go through puberty to experience menarche before age 12. And we really don't know why that is, what the mechanisms, if you will, are for that. So there's some evidence from animal studies that family structure predicts earlier menarche, earlier estrus in rodent models, for instance. And so it could be purely biological. But then there's the piece that I come from, which is psychological. And are there certain stressors in families? If a father leaves the home, if other males are coming into the home, are there certain stressors, be they financial or different levels of disorganization in the family that may also trigger puberty to start early? And we that's really where my research focus is, trying to drill down to those issues.
How do you figure that out? Because there must be so many different causal possibilities. I mean, it's the old question of what's an association and what's causation, right? Because it could be that there's dietary issues going on in that family, or environmental exposures, or obesity. So how would you ever figure out that the trigger is actually whether or not there's a man in the house that's not biologically related?
Well, we do that a couple ways. We by starting early and really assessing these girls early, we have a distinct advantage over other studies that came in later and asked retrospectively, what was your home life like back in the day, kind of thing. So we've started looking at these girls at age 6 and 7, found out what their home lives are like at this age. And we're asking them about a lot of things. We're trying to get a good assessment of what they're eating, how much activity they're getting, their levels of obesity. And when we do that, we can put that into a statistical model, particularly because we have so many girls in this study. And we can control, if you will, for various factors and see, is father absence playing a role above and beyond these other factors? And in fact, we do have a journal article that will be coming out hopefully by the end of the year that's showing that father absence does still have a robust effect even over these other factors that we're including in the model.
Yeah, fascinating and, as you suggest, tricky territory
to
explore. Dr. Juliana Dierdorf joining us this hour along with Dr. Louise Greenspan. Let's get back to our calls, see if we can get through a few more in the few minutes we have remaining. Melissa in Castro Valley. Melissa, go ahead.
Yes, hi. Good morning. I was really fascinated by your discussion this morning because as a tall person, I started puberty at 9. And I found it fascinating that the doctors mentioned that usually you stop growing about 2 years after that. And I stopped growing at age 21. And I was also raised primarily on game meat. I was raised on organic venison and moose meat as well as vegetables. And so I now have a 6.5-year-old daughter. And I'm wondering, is what I experienced genetic, or should I be, looking at signs for her to start puberty early? She's very, very tall.
Melissa, thanks.
So, I'm going to let Louise talk about growth because that's really what she focuses on. But it's interesting because we think about puberty as a discrete event. And puberty is actually really a long process that takes place over a number of years. And so when you start puberty and when you end puberty is very different for many people. And so what we don't think about a lot, but we're starting to in the field, is the pace of puberty and the tempo. And so while you may have started puberty earlier, your pace of puberty may have been slow and it may not have finished until quite later. Right.
Yeah, we don't have the evidence yet that the age of menarche or first period is decreasing as rapidly as the age of appearance of the first breasts. So there's speculation that breast and pubic hair development may be starting earlier, but then instead of taking 2 to 3 years to get your period, it may take 4 to 5 years.
Question from Debbie, who writes in, my 8.5-year-old daughter has started to develop armpit hair. Is that considered to be early puberty? She has no other signs.
No, that's normal.
So that's something that you shouldn't be necessarily concerned about.
It's all in the context, of course, of everything else that's going on. But we call that a secondary sexual characteristic. So things like voice changing, facial hair on boys, armpit hair, body odor, those are not considered to be classic signs of puberty. They're associated. And it could just be that her adrenal glands are waking up. If she doesn't have pubic hair or breast development, it's fine. But actually, after age 8, even a little bit of pubic hair and breast development is totally normal.
Another soy-related question. Our granddaughter will be 8 this fall, is experiencing breast breast growth. She's not obese, very physically active, but it's become very dramatic. And I'm wondering about all the soy products that she's had in her life. Again, any clarity on the great soy question?
I'd like to step back a second and say any 7-year-old with dramatic breast increase should be seen by a pediatrician. So I would not want her to say this is just, oh, she's like all those other girls. So she should have
a dramatic, sorry to be so precise or graphic, but dramatic means what?
Well, again, differentiating fat tissue from breast tissue is hard. And I don't think that should be something parents do. I really don't think moms or dads should be feeling their kids' breasts and we call palpating them. That's something for a pediatrician to do. So I would definitely urge that person to have her evaluated. And in terms of the soy intake, again, it looks like early soy intake is actually protective.
We just have a few minutes left. So let's kind of come back to sort of how parents contend with this phenomenon, what they should be concerned about, what they shouldn't be concerned about, kind of the do's and don'ts of what we should approach and what we can really control. Dr. Dierdorf first.
So I think what we can control and what we should be thinking about is our interactions with our children. All the good things that we recommend for parents during the elementary years, which is establish a good relationship with your child, talk to them about what they're doing, talk to them about their friends. Those are the exact same things that we should continue to do as our girls are going through puberty, even if they're going through puberty early and even more so because they are at risk for things like more behavior problems, early sexual activity, depression, those kinds of things. And so if we've set a foundation pretty early on where there's good communication between us and our children and we're supporting them and we're talking to them about the kind of their fears and their concerns, girls are really worried about being different and looking different. Hmm. And so being able to talk to a stable adult about those issues is important.
And quickly, a resource that you might suggest, you mentioned the Care and Keeping of You, the body book for girls to deal with some of the physical questions. But what about some of these other psychological and social questions that you're dealing with? Are there resources that you recommend, or is it just being a parent and talking the way you need to talk?
You know, there are good resources. And in fact, on our study website, our Signet website, we have a list of various books and other things. And Zero Breast Cancer, one of our community partners, has put out newsletters and a lot of lists of resources that we have for parents.
We'll try to get that added to our forum website later. But a last word, Dr. Greenspan, for you on what parents should be paying attention to.
Well, I think right now we realize this is a true phenomenon. The speculation that puberty is starting early probably is real. The why, we don't know yet. And that's what our study is investigating.
And you'll continue to research this?
We're starting our sixth year right now.
More to report in the months and years ahead. Dr. Louise Greenspan is a pediatric endocrinologist at Kaiser Permanente San Francisco, also with their division of research, co-author of the study. Thanks for being with us
this morning.
Dr. Juliana Dierdorf, assistant professor of maternal and child health at the School of Public Health at UC Berkeley, also very much engaged in this research. Dr. Dierdorf, thanks as well.
Thanks, my pleasure.
Forum is produced by Kevin Guillory, Tina Lorberg, and Judy Campbell. Our senior editor is Dan Zoll. Danny Bringer is our engineer, and our executive producer is Raul Ramirez. I'm Dave Iverson, in for Michael Krasny, and this is Forum on KQED.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Claude and Louise Rosenberg Jr. Family Foundation.